Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker. A Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. And from HR Florida State Council, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 14,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council, a resource for lawmakers, media, and human resource professionals. HRFlorida.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Two familiar health care bills are up for a vote in the Florida House this week, but as in previous years, the plans still face a battle in the other chamber.
I have before you House Bill 37, the direct primary care bill that you've seen, I think, for the past 4 years now. Hopefully this year we'll get it across the finish line.
Also tonight, one lawmaker would like to get a little more bang for his buck when it comes to the lieutenant governor.
Our lieutenant governor really doesn't have any formal responsibilities. And it is, in my view, wasteful.
We'll also find out what Florida's doing about the growing tragedy of human trafficking and learn about the remarkable lady whose statue could represent the Sunshine State in the nation's capital. It's the start of the third week in the nine-week 2018 Florida lawmaking session. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. The Florida House is ready to take up two familiar health care reform measures on Wednesday of this week. Supporters say both bills will make care more accessible and more affordable. But Kate Payne reports the plans face uphill battles in the Senate.
For years, House lawmakers have been trying to codify direct primary care agreements. It's sort of like a health care membership. Subscribers pay a set monthly fee directly to a primary care doc in exchange for a slate of basic services. It cuts out the insurance companies and the middlemen and puts doctors closer to their patients. That's according to bill sponsor Danny Burgess, a Zephyr Hills Republican.
This is just highlighting another choice in health care for patients and providers, something that Dr. Kumar told me once is that this also puts the joy back in the practice of medicine, and I thought that was pretty interesting and insightful.
Dozens of states across the country have recognized these agreements. House Bill 37 would help define what these plans are and what they're not. Chris Newland is with the Florida chapter of the American College of Physicians.
The reason that this bill is necessary is that under current law and the way OIR interprets the current law, you cannot have a monthly payment to your primary care physician to take care of you. It's considered insurance, and you have to be licensed by the insurance code. As far as what this bill does, it actually provides a series of protections for the patient who goes into this arrangement so that they know what they're getting and they know what they're not getting.
Direct primary care is not insurance, and supporters say it's not supposed to be. But for some patients, it could be a more affordable way to get regular checkups and basic testing and screenings. The plan got overwhelming support at its one committee stop, a signal it's on a fast track for passage. Still, the bill has fallen through the cracks in past years, Burgess admits.
Hopefully this year we'll get it across the finish line.
The other healthcare change lawmakers are slated to take up on Wednesday has to do with certificates of need. Right now, certain providers have to have state approval before they build a new hospital, expand a rehab program, or perform open heart surgery or organ transplants. Application fees for this process can cost up to $50,000. Supporters say available services should track a community's needs in order to keep costs down. But Fort Myers Republican Representative Heather Fitzenhagen wants to change that.
HB 27 simply eliminates the need for a certificate of need for hospitals. Removing the CON requirement will remove barriers to entry and increase competition, resulting in more accessible care and reduced prices.
Under Fitzenhagen's bill, hospitals would still have to work with state regulators on licensing. They just wouldn't have to prove a need for their services before building.
What we're doing is we're eliminating the restrictions where we say, can you open a new hospital or not? It's not for us to say. It's for the community demand to say, and it's for the the company that is the hospital business to say.
But those in favor of regulation say free market forces don't really work in healthcare. A car crash victim isn't in the position to shop around for the best deal. And Fort Lauderdale Democrat Bobby DuBose is worried the change could pull staff, resources, and paying patients away from hospitals that depend on them.
There are times when competition isn't always great in certain communities, and there have been, cherry picking that may result. And in some of these areas, especially where you have these safety net hospitals, there's potential for that.
But Fitzenhagen says state regulators would ensure care is available for low-income patients. While the House has overwhelmingly passed versions of both bills in past years, neither got traction in the Senate. It remains to be seen if 2018 will be any different. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
A proposal moving through the Florida Constitution Revision Commission, a body that meets once every two decades to bring proposed constitutional changes directly to voters, would give more duties to the state's lieutenant governor. Regan McCarthy has more.
When Lieutenant Governor Carlos Lopez Cantera was sworn in back in February of 2014, he told reporters he was just glad to be part of the team.
The governor has been doing a great job. I just look forward to being a part of the team and helping in any way that I can.
But Governor Rick Scott had big plans for his new right-hand man.
He's going to work with job creators around the state. He'll be traveling the state, making sure that we continue to build a state where your kids and your grandkids can get a great job.
Since then, though, Lopez Cantera hasn't seen a lot of action. He's spoken at a few functions, like the Florida Tax Watch State of the Taxpayer Dinner back in March. And just this month, he's had several appointments, including a meeting with the Miami mayor and attending a Florida National Guard deployment ceremony. But a quick look at his daily schedule shows quite a lot of free time. In the last 26 days, the lieutenant governor has had activities listed on his public schedule during 11 of those days.
It's been my 20 years of observation that we have a situation in our executive branch where our lieutenant governor really doesn't have any formal responsibilities. And it is, in my view, wasteful.
That's Brandon Republican Senator Tom Lee. He's also a member of the Florida Constitution Revision Commission. Lee says, based on information from 2014, he estimates the state spends more than $1 million to have a lieutenant governor.
And yet under our Constitution, they have no formal responsibility. And to me, this is a bit of a government efficiency opportunity for us to take a look at giving the lieutenant governor some formal responsibilities under our Constitution.
Lee is behind a proposal that would require the lieutenant governor to head up a state agency. It would be up to the governor to decide which one. Don Gates, a former Senate president and another member of the CRC, says the practice isn't unheard of, but it's been a while.
I can tell you that the last lieutenant governor, based on my research, who actually was assigned to run an executive department was Wayne Mixon, who served as lieutenant governor under Governor Graham, and he was Secretary of Commerce, although Lieutenant Governor Tony Jennings was assigned informally a number of specific executive areas.
Meanwhile, CRC member Jackie Thurlow-Lippisch says she sees value in the tasks the lieutenant governor performs today.
Our present lieutenant governor came to Martin County when we had the terrible outrage from Lake Okeechobee of waters that were poisoning our St. Lucie River. And he spoke with the young people, and he was there, and it meant a lot to everybody. The governor was there too, but they came at different times. And the River Kids cooked cookies for him and sent them in the mail, and they never forgot that he was there.
She says that PR or outreach job is an important one too. But Lee counters there's a reason lieutenant governors are so often the punchline of a joke.
There's a story about two sons that Frank Brogan used to tell about two sons. Mother was saying she had one son that went off to sea to become a fisherman, and another went to become lieutenant governor. Two very different stories, and she's never seen either of them since. You know, never heard of either of them since. So kind of the idea that we're just not getting much out of this position.
Lee's measure has passed its first committee in the CRC. It has two left to go before being heard by the full body. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Still to come on Capitol Report, new House and Senate bills hope to make human trafficking awareness more than just a month-long observance.
We must fight before the Sunshine State becomes the trafficked state.
And could a statue of a black educator and activist soon replace one of a Florida Confederate general in the U.S. Capitol?
153 years we've had Statuary Hall. There's not one African American in Statuary Hall representing the state, not one. So we're about to make history.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org.
The month of January is dedicated to raising awareness of human trafficking, but the Florida House and Senate want to make awareness a year-round effort. We get that story from Andrew Quintana.
Brittany Liebert is a child sex abuse survivor. However, according to her, surviving is only half the battle.
Well, it's rough. And it's confusing. And if you are not helped, you can end up making a lot of terrible choices and reliving your experiences every day. For me, it was 16 years. But if there was an FDWO, maybe it would have been 16 hours.
Liebert is now the program director of the Female Development World Organization, or FDWO. Organizations like these create a support system for victims of abuse, and in recent years, they have been putting a lot of that effort towards victims of human trafficking. While many people think of slavery as a thing of the past, experts say modern-day slavery, in the form of human trafficking, is a booming business. The International Labor Organization estimates that forced labor through human trafficking generates around $150 billion as an industry.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want you to understand that of all the crimes in the world, human trafficking is number one cash business, more than drugs, more than weapons. The trafficking in human lives.
Former State Senator Maria Sachs is the founder of the Coalition Against Human Trafficking. Sachs spoke at a press conference Monday that introduced House Bill 159 and Senate Bill 596. Both bills address the rising rate of human trafficking in Florida by not only raising awareness of trafficking tactics through educational campaigns, but by also requiring the Attorney General's office to establish a statewide toll-free human trafficking report hotline. What sets this hotline apart from other child abuse hotlines in Florida is it will primarily focus on human trafficking. Florida is third in the nation in reported human trafficking incidents. Bills like these, according to Miami Democratic Representative Robert Asensio, could combat that by informing the public and offering a direct line to law enforcement.
I will tell you that it was a constant struggle to educate our members of law enforcement on the signs of these predators. I can't tell you how awful it is, firsthand knowledge, to come encounter a child who has been victimized, a family who has been victimized, and often family members, those most closest to them, one, don't know the signs, or worse yet, have no way to report.
Under the legislation, reports made to the hotline would immediately go to law enforcement agencies for investigation. Former U.S. Attorney Pamela Marsh believes this can help law enforcement narrow down future trafficking cases and turn the tides against the industry.
Which will make it easier for investigators to get those tips, for Floridians to report the crimes, and it may increase law enforcement's ability to investigate, track down good evidence, support these victims so that they can become witnesses and give the testimony that's necessary to put the prosecutor, to put the perpetrator behind bars.
Both the House and Senate bills are waiting to be heard in their first committee. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Angie Quintana.
While advocates were talking about human trafficking at the Capitol today, healthcare professionals a few blocks away were getting some consciousness raising of their own on the topic. As we hear from Margie Menzel, these are the people who often are among the first to encounter trafficking victims, but too often miss the signs.
When I talk to physicians, nurse practitioners, PAs, I'm often met with,
But I don't see these patients in my office. But I get that when I train about child abuse and elder abuse and domestic violence, too. Well, they are, but they aren't recognizing it.
Suzanne Harrison is the director of clinical programs at the Florida State University College of Medicine. She says doctors and other healthcare professionals see patients who are being trafficked all the time, but they don't know it and thus miss the chance to help. She cites a 2014 study of trafficking survivors.
And these women that were interviewed, almost 90% of them intersected with the healthcare industry in some capacity, whether it was an office, Planned Parenthood, an emergency room, Department of Health. None were identified. Zero.
Harrison was training about 60 healthcare professionals on Friday as part of the Big Bend's efforts to raise awareness of labor and sex trafficking this month. The training was a collaboration by the State Department of Health, the College of Medicine, and the Survive and Thrive Advocacy Center. Harrison told attendees healthcare professionals are trained to look for signs of child abuse and domestic violence, and that human trafficking has some parallels. For one thing, the healthcare professional shouldn't ask about potential abuse unless he or she can get the victim alone.
We don't want to increase their risk. We don't want to increase their risk of serious injury, any kind of harm. And they're likely to be beaten badly after the healthcare encounter if we ask in front of an abuser, a perpetrator, a trafficker, a pimp, whatever you want to label these people, right? And so we don't ask if we can't get them alone.
Harrison says it takes a team to identify potential victims, and she advises physicians to get their frontline staff trained as well as themselves. Staffers can help connect with the victim one-on-one or distract the trafficker with paperwork, she said. And above all, a little compassion helps to establish trust.
These young women and men oftentimes haven't eaten all day, and so a little bit of food goes a long way.
Trafficking reports to the Department of Children and Families have gone up since 2009, when DCF added trafficking to its maltreatment index. That year, there were just 43 reports. In 2016, there were 1,495 reports, showing why healthcare professionals, as mandated reporters, can have a huge role in combating modern-day slavery. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Margie Menzel.
The South Florida Water Management District is laying out several scenarios for building a reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee. The reservoir is a priority of Senate President Joe Negron and funded by both the state and federal governments to address both polluted runoffs downstream and to help rebuild the Everglades. But as Lynn Hatter reports, environmental groups and Negron say they want more lands to be taken into consideration.
The summer of 2013 was dubbed the Lost Summer by some after toxic algae blooms, spurred by a month of rain, sent polluted water runoff from Lake Okeechobee flooding into the St. Lucie and Caloosahatchee Rivers. It killed fish, dolphins, seagrass, and oysters in the Indian River Lagoon.
When algae comes in, it's basically blanketing the top of the water, which isn't allowing sunlight to penetrate the water, which isn't allowing the seagrass beds to grow and produce oxygen, which is also part of the die-off. And if we're
in places like Senate President Joe Negron's home base of Stewart, where Megan Roberts worked at the time as a spokesman for the Florida Oceanographic Society, the problem hit oysters particularly hard.
The baseline at 100%. If we even recover to 80% but end up with a wet season next year, we're going to have another die-off and more issues, and we'll only be able to recover to 60% maybe the following year. So recovery with the current discharges is never going to be able to sort of match, sort of
what
a baseline what we lost.
The problems returned a few years ago, spawning even more animal deaths and once again depressing tourism in the area. Negron pitched Senate Bill 10 last year as a way to ease pollution in the St. Lucie and Caloosahatchee Rivers. The measure directed the South Florida Water Management District to study options for where to put the reservoir, and the recently delivered report lays out four scenarios. All involve using two large parcels of state-owned land for construction, but that's not quite what Negron had in mind.
We want to make sure that the reservoir is large enough to accomplish its objective.
At issue was how much land should be on the table. The reservoir will eventually be located in the Everglades Agricultural Area south of Lake Okeechobee and north of Everglades proper. Much of the land is owned by companies like U.S. Sugar and Florida Crystals, but as agriculture companies have left, the state has bought up many parcels, some near or connected to the bigger tracts, and others that are sort of scattered about. And Negron believes those scattered parcels should also be up for consideration.
From my conversations with the district, they want the footprint to be large enough to accomplish the objective of having between 100 billion and 120 billion gallons of dynamic storage. So I'm hopeful that they'll look for creative ways through land swaps, through early lease terminations. Also, if there are any willing sellers that will be willing to either sell land or to swap land, perhaps with some additional payment.
That view is shared by Audubon Florida. The environmental group believes the Water Management District's four scenarios are too narrow and that the agency didn't do all that it could have, says Audubon's Celeste DePalma.
Well, next we're going to have to work with our federal partners to make sure that we have a report that looks at all of the options that gives us the optimized plan to make this reservoir a reality and then hopefully get it through Congress so that we can get it authorized and then move forward with design and construction of this project.
The purpose of the entire plan is to take water away from places that have too much of it and move water toward places where there's not enough, like the Everglades, where the water would have historically gone. DePalma says it's still early in the process.
At the end of the day, we all want a project that is going to give us the most benefit and optimizes the use of lands that we have and all of the tools that were put into this bill so we can have the best project that we can get.
There's not a final plan yet on how to execute the reservoir. Whichever proposal the state decides to go with will have to gain congressional approval and federal funding as well. Then there's the planning stage, followed by construction. And that means an actual reservoir is still years away. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, of Florida's four historically black colleges and universities, only Bethune-Cookman University was founded in the early 1900s and named after an African-American woman. As Sasha Cordner reports, we'll learn more about Mary McLeod Bethune, who could soon make history in Washington, D.C.
This month, Bethune-Cookman University students, faculty, and alumni celebrated the fifth annual Wildcat Day at the Capitol on the steps of the old Florida Capitol building. How well do you know this HBCU? Mr. and Ms. BCU Joshua Cox and Amin Adesay have a little quiz.
Which HBCU is the first and only school in the state of Florida to have online degrees nationally certified?
BCU!
Y'all got that right.
All right. All right. Which school in our state was the first HBCU to establish a college of entrepreneurship and business?
BCU!
And that's not all, says Keyshawn Kindred, BCU's Student Government Association president.
No matter where you go in the world, you will find there is no place like BCU. From the College of Undergraduate Studies to state-of-the-art programs in hospitality management, from the championship-winning Fighting Wildcat football team to the international award-winning band and choral groups.
Let every voice and sing.
Let every voice and sing. To let the heaven ring. Ring with the harmonies of men.
Let every voice and sing.
As you all were singing, lift every voice and sing. And I look and I see the flag of the United States. It gave me a moment to pause and think about the words of that song.
That's the school's interim president, Hubert Grimes, talking to a group of students about BCU's Concert Chorale's performance of the Black National Anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing.
You see, Wildcats, I want to take you back for just a moment historically and look at the shoulders that you're standing on.
Grimes says they all wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the school's founder, Mary McLeod Bethune. And Earl Robinson Jr., a BCU sophomore, says she's not forgotten.
We remember the spirit of our founder, Dr. Mary McLeod Bethune, a woman by faith began a school with just five little girls and $1.50 and faith in you.
In recent years, Mary McLeod Bethune has garnered much attention at the Florida Capitol. There's an effort underway to take down a statue of a Confederate general representing Florida in the U.S. Capitol and replacing him with an effigy of Bethune. BCU's First Lady and Class of 1970 alumni Daisy Grimes says it's warranted because Bethune literally turned a city dump in Daytona Beach into the place of learning it is today.
She went to meet with Mr. James Gamble, who was the owner of Procter & Gamble, to encourage him to come and support her school. Mr. Gamble comes over to the area with Mrs. Bethune, and he sees a city dump. And he's asking her this question, what do you want me to invest in? Where's your school? She said, it's in my heart. It's in my head. It is my vision to make life better for my people. Mr. Gamble became the first chairman of the Board of Trustees for our university. Can you imagine?
So far, bills to put Bethune in the National Statuary Hall are moving in both chambers of the Florida legislature. And Ashley Robertson says she couldn't be more excited. Robertson is a BCU history professor and director of the Mary McLeod Bethune Foundation, the historic home where Bethune lived most of her life.
I mean, when you look at the United States Capitol, where the statue is going to be housed, the Capitol was built by slaves. So it's going to be awesome to have a woman who was the daughter of enslaved parents. Her brothers and sisters were enslaved. It's only right that she should be placed inside of the Capitol with this great statue. And she's going to be a woman that's going to receive the statue. So that would be awesome, you know, because there are only 9 women that are represented by various states right now.
If the Florida legislature passes the measure and the governor signs it, Bethune would also make history as the first African American to be represented in the National Statuary Hall in Washington, D.C. Among the bill's sponsors is Daytona Beach Representative Patrick Henry, an alumni of Bethune-Cookman University. According to Henry, the state would not be on the hook for replacing the statue, as BCU is expected to raise the funds. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank Andrew Quintana, Margie Menzel, our sister operation, the Florida Channel, and contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. And please join us each weeknight at this time throughout the 2018 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at wfsu.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes, offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. And from HR Florida State Council, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 14,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council, a resource for lawmakers, media, and human resource professionals. HRFlorida.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.